Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Ecclesiastes chapter 10. There's something very unusual about this whole section of Ecclesiastes. Have you been able to pick it out? When you read through this, did something seem to switch gears? Did it seem to be have any unity at all? There's a way just by looking at your reference Bible that you can tell something has changed. And that's why a cross-reference Bible is so vitally important to studying the Word of God. If you'll just look back a couple of chapters, and just anywhere in the book of Ecclesiastes, and look at your references. Look at the cross-references. Most of the cross-references, if there are any, are in the book of Ecclesiastes itself. Now, there are a few outside of it, but most of the references everywhere else in the book of Ecclesiastes are to Ecclesiastes. And the ones that aren't are really not related passages. They're just the same kind of subject. But beginning in the last part of chapter 9, and also in chapter 10, if you'll look on the side of your cross-reference Bible, you'll begin to discover an inordinate amount of references from the book of Proverbs. The wisdom teacher has shifted gears, if you please. He is going into his traditional stance as a wisdom teacher to a particular group of students. He is going into the stance of a traditional wisdom teacher that is the same stance as the book of Proverbs is, and many other books that are outside our Bible, like the book of Ecclesiasticus. Now, in so doing, he has left his very sharp, poignant criticism of society. Now, he's still looking at life on a human perspective sometimes, but he's going into his general teachings. And the general teachings that I have found, and this is not something that every commentator will agree, for if you've read any at all on commentaries on Ecclesiastes, it is amazing what people get out of this book. My favorite commentator, Leupold, finds in the 10th chapter of Ecclesiastes, he finds a reference to the Persian rulers that he found in chapter 9. I find no reference whatsoever to Persian rulers in chapter 9 or chapter 10. But I do think that chapter 10 is a prolonged discussion to middle, upper class youth that are going into governmental service on how to react to government policies, to the king, and to situations in life. Now, there are going to be many cross-references to Proverbs. Proverbs, as you remember when we went through that book, is like the traditional Jewish sermon. Jews did not write a logical sermon like we would from a Greek mind with points and illustrations, but they would write sermons like unrelated parts, like beads on a string, and they would jump from one subject to another subject to another subject with seemingly no connection whatsoever with the pearls. Now, that's exactly what the 10th chapter is. It has a loose kind of configuration of maxims for people in governmental service, but generally the context is very loose. Now, chapter 10 must be related to chapter 9, verse 18. Especially 18b. For one sinner destroys much good. For picking up in chapter 10, verse 1, is the same idea. Now, I'm going to be doing two things. I'm going to go through here on a word and phrase study, and then in a parenthesis, I'm going to give you what I think it's trying to say to young people going into governmental service. Okay? And, of course, the application is much wider than that in our day, but I think it was rather limited in the days of Coley, of the preacher here, the professor. Now, the first verse says, dead flies make a perfumer's oil stink. It's amazing. The Hebrew word here is been called great problems. If you pick up five translations, you'll have five different things. Some have deadly flies. Some have dead flies. I think the best way to translate these Hebrew words are dying flies. Flies caught in the ointment that are fluttering around. You've seen them. Hopefully not in your perfume, but you've seen them like that. Now, dying flies make a perfumer's oil stink. So a little foolishness is weightier than wisdom and honor. Now the word weightier here, they get this translation, this Hebrew word, not from other uses in Hebrew. Now you just think me for a minute. How do you know what a word means? For a long time, there was no Koine Greek available except the Bible. And so scholars begin to say that the Bible was written in Holy Spirit Greek, which means they had never found any other Greek like that, and it was totally different. They said, well, this is a special Greek that God gave just to write the Bible. But after we started digging around in Egypt and found some garbage piles of Alexandria and found a lot of uses of these Greek words, we found that it was a common Greek of the day. But the way that we know what biblical words mean when they're used only one time or maybe even two times and sometimes in different contexts is to compare how this word was used in secular society. That's exactly how you do in the Old Testament. Now, every other place that this Hebrew word is used, it means precious or rare. Now, in cognate languages like Aramaic, Sanskrit, Ugaritic, those kind of languages, the word means weightier. So it's been a big fight over translators. So how do you translate this thing? The meaning here, I think, is this. So as a dying fly caught in the ointment can't really help you accomplish anything, so one act of foolishness, even with a good reputation of wisdom, will cause you to be degraded. I think it says a little foolishness outweighs wisdom and honor. Or what means it this way? A few acts of foolishness can ruin a reputation of wisdom. So as a fly can't help himself, neither can foolishness accomplish anything. That's kind of what the sense of this is. Now, it goes back, I think, to the thing about one sinner destroys much good. Now, notice if you would in verse 2, please. By the way, I think this whole section here is related to 7:1. If you'll go back and look at that, it says, a good name is better than a good ointment. That's where I get the idea of a good reputation can be ruined by just a little tomfoolery can really, really hurt. Now, in chapter 10, verse 2, a wise man's heart directs him toward the right, but a foolish man's heart directs him toward the left. In the biblical understanding, because most people, are right-handed, and you look so awkward. Have you ever tried to play baseball with a left-handed glove when you're right-handed? And you throw like you know, my goodness, you can't get it where you want to. Since the left hand is so uncoordinated, usually, and so clumsy compared to the right hand, the left hand, the Bible has always spoken of as being evil or weak or non-harmonious. The right hand, on the other hand, is always spoken of as might, strength, power, effectiveness. A good example of this in the New Testament is Matthew chapter 25, verses 31 through 41. This is the great white throne judgment, and Jesus says to those, you on my right hand, blessed are you, and the kingdom has been prepared for you, but you on my left hand, cursed are you. There's one example. There's many more in the Bible. Many times talk about that God redeemed them with his strong right arm. So right means honor, strength, power. Left means weakness, evil, that kind of thing. Now, notice that the Hebrew word for heart speaks about the total personality. Emotions, intellect, and will are all caught up in this idea of the heart, okay? That's what it is, the heart directs. Now, in verse 3, even when the fool walks along the road, his sense is lacking, and he demonstrates to everyone that he is a fool. Now, please put down Proverbs 23:7 and Matthew 15:11. The true nature of man will come out. Now, Matthew 15 passage is one that says it's not what goes in a man that defiles him, it's what comes out, meaning that what you truly are is going to come out. You can't fake everybody all the time. And just as a fool walks along the road, shows himself, so men and women and young people, by the nature of their lifestyles, show what kind of people they really are. That's why it's so totally preposterous to say you believe something, but you live an entirely different life. How you live is what you really believe. Now, You see where it talks about in verse 4? If the ruler's temper rises against you, do not abandon your position, because composure allies great offenses. Now, there's two proverbs that fit right here. Proverbs 15:18 and Proverbs 16:14. Now, it's saying when the ruler's temper really gets mad at you. Let's put it in our context. When your boss throws a fit, gets red-faced over something that you think is totally inappropriate, does it help for you to get red-faced back? Or is it true that sometimes a soft word turneth away wrath? He's saying, don't leave your post. Don't resign when the king gets uptight. Give him a while. If your words were true and your words were wise, he'll come back to them. He'll regard them. Don't quit in a huff. Cool it. Wait a while. See what happens. Now, I think that the word composure and calmness are the exact same word, and you can take either one. Now, the word for ruler here is a different word for ruler than in verse 5, and that's very important. In verse 5, it says, there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, like an error which goes forth from the ruler. Now, under the sun, to me, means, humanly speaking, or in a humanly sphere, there is an evil, humanly speaking, the word error there, in verse 5, the word error means unintentional error. There is an unintentional error which goes forth from the ruler. Now, many commentators, because of the different word for ruler used in verse 5 and verse 4, want to make God the object of verse 5. That the writer is saying that God has done things wrong. There is an evil in God, that God has made a mistake. Now, they base this on the fact of the definite article with the word ruler, the ruler, and on the different word for ruler from verse 5 and verse 4, and the fact that in the book of Daniel, this word for ruler in verse 5 is often used for God. Daniel 4:17, Daniel 4:25, Daniel 4:26, Daniel 4:32, and Daniel 5:21 all use this word to describe God. Now, I think that although we have to look at that exegetically, that because of the context, that's totally out of context with what I think the general theme is, and that is how to function in government service. And you say, that's way off base. The book of Proverbs is the same kind of book. It's written toward a middle-class youth on how to get along in society. And so Coleth is doing the same thing that he's really trained to do, and that is be a wisdom teacher to the youth in his society. Now, so I think even though a different word is used, that what we have here is a typical typical piece of advice in the face of earthly rule. What he's saying is, rulers don't always make the right decisions. Rulers don't always make decisions that are practical, that are good, that are helpful. Sometimes they make dumb decisions. Okay? Now, here is an example of the evil that he's seen from the ruler. Number 6, folly is set in many exalted places, while rich men sit in humble places. I have seen slaves riding on horses and princes walking like slaves on the land. Now, verse 7, Proverbs 19:10 fits very well there. What he's saying is, the reason that this world is so topsy-turvy is that the good, the wise, should be exalted. But what happens is sometimes political systems put corrupt and inept men in political places of leadership because of favoritism or relatives or power structures. And it's not always the wise and the trained and the apt, but sometimes it's the political expediency, is it not? So I think that verses 5 through 7, the general thing with this, often in government, friend and favors are the standard more than merit and training. Okay, I think that's what 5 through 7 is talking about. Now, verse 8. He who digs a pit may fall into it, and a serpent may bite him who breaks through a wall. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits logs may be endangered by them. I think verse 8 and 9 could be summed up this way before I get into it. Don't try to feather your own bed at the expense of others. You say, how does that fit? Let's go back through. He who digs a pit may fall into it. Now, that is a common proverb found all through the Bible. It's found in Psalm 7:15. It's found in Proverbs 26:27. It's saying when you lay a snare for someone else, you're liable to get caught in your own snare. If you try to roll a rock on someone else, it's just liable the rock's going to roll back on you. Now, that is exactly what digging a pit and a serpent, being bit by a serpent when you break through a wall is. Now, the word for break through a wall is really, the Hebrew word here means a wooden fence, a vineyard fence, if you please. A hedge is not a bad translation in the King James. Someone who is tearing down his neighbor's fence may very well get bit by a snake, which means tearing your neighbor's thing down. So, and then in verse 9, it seems like verse 8 is talking about destruction, while verse 9 is probably talking about building up. If you're trying to feather your own nest, there's other words for that, by just helping someone else, not because you care about them, because you want to, but just so you'll get a look better in their eyes, or so you'll get a better position, is the idea about quarrying a stone and chopping logs. Friends, there's even danger in quarrying stones and chopping logs if it's all for the self-motivated interest, you see. Well, I think 9 and 10 are talking about don't let self-interest become the predominant thing of your life in government service, because you're liable to get caught in your own traps. Now, verse 10 is one of the most difficult verses in all the Bible. I think 10 and 11 are related, so I'll read them together if I could, please. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. If a serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. Now, I want to sum up what I think the advice to governmental workers is in this. I think verses 10 and 11 are saying, think ahead, be prepared. Okay, let me show you why. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wait, say, if you had a little forethought, if you took a little time to prepare the axe, the work would go a lot easier for you. And so in the last little section, wisdom has the advantage of getting success, and I want to put a parenthesis in there for my understanding. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success if proper preparation is made. Now, that helps me understand what the Hebrew text, I think, is trying to say. That's what the axe is trying to say. If you chop a tree with a dull axe, you can do it, but it's going to take a lot more sweat. If you just sharpen the edge a little bit, the tree will fall much easier. Same with wisdom. Wisdom is good if preparation is made, you see. And verse 11 is the same thing. If you are a snake charmer, and you rush in because you're late for your performance, and you don't charm that snake enough, and he bites you on the end of the nose, it's not that snake's fault, it's lack of preparation on your part. If you'd have taken a little more time and done what you know should have been done, that snake wouldn't have bit you. Preparation is often the key. Don't rush in half-cocked. Now, verse 12 through 15, I think, are talking about watch your tongue. This is what I put in my margin about 12 through 15, and also verses 2 and 3. Give the fool enough time to talk, and he'll hang himself. Give that guy who's trying to feather his own nest by playing up to the boss and axing your work, give him enough time to talk, and his true nature will come out in his actions. He'll hang himself. Now, here we go. Words from the mouth of a wise man are gracious, while the lips of fools consume him. Again, Matthew 15:11. Words convey the character. It's not what goes into a man that defiles him. It's what comes out of a man. Again, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. The true man will come out. Now, verse 13. The beginnings of his talking is folly, and the end of it is wicked madness. Yet the fool multiplies words. No man knows what will happen. Who can tell him what will come after him? The toil of a fool so wearies him that he does not even know how to go into the city. Now, this idea in verse 14, there's two things here that are very important, I think. Number one, no man knows what will happen. This is talking about planning for tomorrow. We have no basis to plan for tomorrow except in the will of God. Two New Testament examples. Luke 12, 13 through 21. The rich fool. I'm going to sit back and build bigger barns. I'm just going to take my ease. I've got things made. And God says, you fool, tonight your soul will be required of thee. James 4:13-17. You who say, let's go into a foreign city and make gain and do business, when you do not know what tomorrow is, what is your life but a vapor that's here today and gone tomorrow? You can't plan next year, next month, 5 years, 10 years, unless it's in the will of God. It's presumptuous to count for tomorrow. Now, the second part of that, what will happen? Who can tell him what will come after him? A good passage for this, I think, is Job 14:21. When Job says something like, once you're dead, no one tells you whether your children have done a good job or have utterly failed. You don't know. No one tells you. Now, I can really identify with verse 15. What this is saying is, he does not even know how to go to the city. This poor boy can't read road signs. So to speak, this boy can't read a map. This is the kind of guy who would go to Fort Worth through Oklahoma. And I identify quite well with that kind of fella. So I don't think it's necessarily a fool who can't read a map. But anyway, it's saying this guy, a good way to put this English, say this boy doesn't even get out of the rain. He just stands out in the rain, you know. So he's so stupid he can't find town. That's what it's saying. Now, verse 16 through 19, I have money and power can't sustain an efficient government. The United States needs to hear that. Money and power can't sustain an inefficient government. Let's look at it. Woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad. Now, the word lad here is a word for child. It can be used of a grown man. Therefore, it means immature, not responsive to the wisdom of God, something like that. Whose king is a lad, whose princes feast in the morning. Blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through insolence the rafters sag, and through slackness houses leak. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, and wine makes a life merry, and money is the answer to everything. Okay, look what it's saying. A king who uses his money and luxurious living is going to make a weak nation. Riches usually lead to lazy living. That's exactly what has happened to the United States. You know that? We have had so much so long that we forgot the price, the real price of being free. Now, the king here is a king who gets up early in the morning and who has a feast. He gets cropped. He gets bombed. He has eggs and wine for breakfast. Now, notice it says, Dan 17, they eat not for strength, but they eat for drunkenness. That's the implication, you see. Now, the Bible rails against drunkenness. It says you are a fool if you look on the wine while it's red. You are simply the epitome of stupid if you drink till you're drunk. But the Bible does not teach don't drink anything. You hear what I'm saying? Drunkenness is just railed against, but never does it say total abstinence. And for any of you who that upsets, I just challenge you to bring your Bible and come sit with me sometime. Now, notice here, the problem is these men are taking wine and using it for drunkenness. They're escaping from reality and the responsibilities of life and office by becoming intoxicated. That's always, always dumb. Now, notice in verse 18, through insolence the rafters sag, and through slackness houses leak. Government as well as private houses need continual repairs. Continual maintenance, continual revision, continual working at it, okay? And if you just let your house, no matter how well your house is built, if you just let it sit 15 or 20 years and don't do anything to it, the first thunderstorm comes along, it will leak like a sieve and blow down. Nothing can last without working at it. And that includes churches and governments and people's spiritual lives and anything else. So, here I think we have, in verse 19, the epitome of it all. This is, verse 19 is summing up life under this kind of lackadaisical drunken system. Number one, men prepare meal for enjoyment. They eat just because they like it, not for strength. They eat just because they want to eat. There's many accounts in Greek literature of guys who got up and ate and then made themselves sick so they could eat and eat and eat some more. Do you know that? Common thing. Gluttony. I'm not going to talk too much on gluttony. And wine makes life merry. Now, people get all uptight about wine making life merry. If you have a reference Bible, I want you to look up something like Psalms 104:15 that will say, God gives wine to make the heart of man glad. What God gives is not evil. It's when man abuses what God gives, it becomes evil. And that is true of sex, or wine, or power, or money, or your physical body, or anything you have. God has given everything as a gift, but sinful man tends to abuse every gift of God. Now, notice if you would please, verse 20. My summation of verse 20, don't ridicule the powers that be. Walls have ears. Furthermore, in your bedchamber, do not curse the king. Now, the curse is much, much too strong of a word here. It's really, do not esteem lightly. Do not make fun of. Do not ridicule the powers that be, the king. In your bedchamber, in your sleeping rooms, do not esteem lightly a rich man. For a bird of the heavens will carry the sound, and the winged creatures will make the matter known. Have you ever heard little bird told me? That's right from here. And the word little winged creatures mean, friends, you just can't make sure all the birds are gone, because little winged creatures means that gnats and flies and mosquitoes can also carry the word around. So you can't just make sure the birds aren't around. The walls have ears. What it's saying is just don't be criticizing folks. Now I want you to catch a little bit of the flavor of Kohelet. I want you to catch who he is and what he's doing. He said the most terrible wickedness he's seen is the rich and the wise in places of the humble, and the slave and the poor man in the place of the rich and the wise man. And then he said over here that blessed is the land who the king is of nobility. Did you catch that? The king is of nobility. And then it talks about, let me find the other one. Don't curse a rich man down here. Kohelet was an upper middle class philosopher. The peasant made good was not Kohelet's ideal of a fair shot. The noble man, the man of fine living and fine breeding, who normally moves into a high position job, now that for Kohelet was what's normal. But you see, the slave who has pulled himself by his bootstraps and made good to Kohelet is an evil. Now, do you catch the middle class aurora of this man's teaching? Now, friends, he wasn't your local HUD office representative. This guy is typical redneck, middle-class Hebrew wisdom teacher. And anybody who makes it that's not either a Hebrew and a God-fearer or a born of nobility is, in his sense, inferior and shouldn't be where he is. And that's pretty tough, isn't it? Okay. Questions or comments on chapter 10? I think he would, yeah. Get him out of there. Did you catch that as you read through there, Paul? That little flavor of, it's kind of like a little dig, isn't it, you know? It really is, yeah. He's just not your local civil rights leader. He really is. Yes, Winston. That all of us are sinful and all of our interpretations are bad. The New Testament does do that. They rip context. But I'm committed to the fact they're led by the Holy Spirit, which I'm not. And so I let them do it and I won't let me. And they do it bad sometimes. Paul, oh my word, bad. Yes, any other comments? Did you catch the flavor? Do you feel like this is one context of instructions about governmental service? Did you catch that going through, or you think that's far-fetched? Leupold goes through the same chapter. Boy, I love Leupold. Man, he's a good one. And he finds the Persian kings all the way through here. But you see, it's a presupposition that Ecclesiastes was written in the Persian period. Totally presuppositional. We have not one scrap of proof. You say Persian words. Persian words are used in Daniel. Daniel, I think, is written early. I mean, late in the sense of being hundreds of years before Christ. So Persian words won't cut it. But you see how a presupposition gets in, and then he interprets the Bible on the basis of his presupposition? We all do it, though. I'm interpreting this chapter on the basis of my presupposition that Coley has changed stances from kind of a critic to a... Man, he's teaching the same things Proverbs teaches here. In chapters 9 previous, he has been axing Proverbs. He's been saying, you guys are fools. This is not true. You say this, but you know it's not true. And now he's changed ground, and he's going right down traditional lines with Proverbs in chapter 10. So, I have no idea. Unless this particular area of governmental service he agrees with, where their general philosophy about the place of evil in the righteous he disagrees with. So unless he just happened to agree with this subject, and really some of these things are almost pulled right out of Proverbs, word for word almost. This thing about the pit is just word for word Psalms and Proverbs. So he knew that literature and just quotes it here for his purpose.